bed, but...
But when you close the hospital, the nurses can follow the patient.
Yes. That's, although New Orleans was a good case in point on that. A lot of the nurses did not follow the patients. A lot of the hospitals that accepted patients, even as far away as Houston, were woefully understaffed because they were suddenly at 10 plus capacity. But they didn't get the New Orleans nurses. New Orleans nurses went to their families scattered across wherever.
They stayed with their kids.
Oh, lucky kids. Sorry,
you
can
have your patients.
It was payback time.
It's a planning call.
Yeah,
it changes the planning.
But it's all a plan. My point is, our basic point is that there's a lot of costs involved, and it's a bigger planning issue. It's not just like one hospital or a simple reciprocal relations. It's area-wide. Thank you.
Okay, this is the Health Economics Access to Healthcare session, and the next speaker will be Aaron Katz, as it says up there. He's from University of Washington. He's talking about caught in the competitive crossfire of balancing margin and mission.
Good morning. This is quite an eclectic panel. Now I don't know whether to present this or the paper I'm presenting at 10:30 on preparedness. But I'll stick with this one because the other one's not loaded. All right, okay. You could present mine at 10:30 if you'd like. Before I start, I have just a crazy thought about Shin's presentation about how much it would cost to cover the uninsured. We know that we actually know how to cover people. That's no great magic. The challenge has always been, as you point out, cost and where to come up with the money. So we have to find some way to control costs. But you know, in the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks or so, there have been some astounding reports in the newspaper about for the first time we're seeing a reduction in the number of prescriptions being written, number of physician visits. So I think the solution we have is if we call our congresspeople now and tell them not to do anything about the financial crisis, maybe rescind everything they've done to make sure this crisis extends out for 5 or 10 years, we'll solve the cost problem and then we'll be able to afford to cover everybody.
Cheaper gas, right?
Cheaper gas too, exactly. Anyhow, So I'm going to talk about the result of some research I've been involved with over the last 10 years, in fact. I don't have any conflicts of interest. I have lots of conflicts, but no conflicts of interest. My collaborators on this particular research are from Virginia Commonwealth in a study that was carried out by the Center for Studying Health System Change in Washington, D.C., this study is a longitudinal study of healthcare market change funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's been going on since 1996. These 12 communities you see here have been part of the study for those years. And basically, the study involves at least part of the study I'm involved in is site visits that we do every 2 years to these 12 communities. A team of researchers descends on these communities and interviews between 75 and 100 people in each community, everywhere from community activists or community organizers to political leaders, the heads of health plans, hospitals, medical groups, and the like. So we try to cover the array of perspectives on what's going on in the healthcare system. We do have research agendas, but basically what we're asking people is, what's happening in your healthcare market, and how has that changed over the last 2 years, and does it matter, and in what way does it matter? We have fairly thick protocols, but basically that's what the research is. So I've been fortunate to be focused in this research on the public sector and particularly the safety net. And so what I'm going to report here on is sort of a look back over, I would say, the last 4 or 6 years on how safety net providers have responded to and survived the marketplace. So I can see a number of us in the room remembers the old arms race in medicine, which basically was hospitals buying the next new gadget you know, whether it's a CT scanner or MRI or whatever. And that was the way to attract physician business and therefore patient business. The new medical arms race is a bit different in a number of ways, but most particularly what distinguishes it from the old arms race is the involvement of physicians in this arms race. Basically, you have physicians now interested in obtaining the facility fees. That is, you know, in the old days, a physician came into the hospital, what we used to call the doctor's workshop, right, and did his or her thing and left, and the hospital got the fees for whatever the procedure was. Well, physicians are interested in retaining those fees, and so they're setting up facilities in some places, independent hospitals, in order to capture those fees. Of course, physicians have been trying to put together ancillary services, radiological services, and the like in their own practices, which gets around the constraints on self-referral. Growth of ambulatory surgery centers, that's been going on for a while. Single specialty groups, I'll talk about that in a bit more, but really this has been the scaling up of medical groups, which allows them to compete better in the marketplace. Hospital responses to this new variation on the medical arms race includes basically saying, hey, physicians, we'll go into to a joint venture with you so that if they're going to lose something, the hospitals are going to lose something, at least they won't lose everything. Hospitals have been building new facilities and renovating facilities and relocating to suburban areas where the money is. So we, in the last round of site visits, these are the construction activities we saw among hospitals in part in response to this new medical arms race. And you can see, you know, again, building new full-service hospitals, expanding existing specialty services, replacing aged facilities, and expanding capacity in certain areas that the hospitals felt were going to be income generating and not not money losing. So the implications of this, of the arms race per se, is that unlike the old arms race at the time it was taking place in the 70s and 80s, when a hospital added a new expensive diagnostic piece of equipment or added a new wing, all the payers just paid up. They paid the bill for that new item. Nowadays, things are different. Public payers are more stingy as they need to be. Consolidations among health plans have given those health plans more leverage in negotiating with providers, if there's any negotiating at all. And the other thing is, this is really a question we have, less than a direct observation, is that given that hospitals have had to service the debt to do the renovation, to try to win in this new arms race, the question is does that mean that less of the profits or margins are available for charity care? So speaking of charity care, we know, of course, that the number of uninsured has been growing in the country and every area of the country, and that total uncompensated care in hospitals has been going up. But hospital uncompensated care as a percentage of expenses has actually been going down. That's where we sort of raise some questions about whether debt service has been substituting for funds for charity care. And likewise, very importantly, the proportion of physicians who provide any charity care has been going down. And what that means, of course, is that the number of providers for people without means has been getting a bit slimmer. So, pressures on safety net providers given this picture. With the decline in employer-based coverage, Increases in the number of immigrants without coverage, at least up until recently, when I've seen reports of the number of immigrants in this country dropping a bit. In some states, cuts in Medicaid. What that has meant, for example, among community health centers, is that they've seen an increase from 4 million patients to 6 million patients from 2001 to 2006. So that's an increase of 50% during that period. During that same period, community health centers has seen a 170% increase in mental health patients and an 80% increase in dental visits. As I said, fewer alternative providers, the number of physicians who are seeing low-income folks has been dropping. Poor access to specialists, this has been a chronic problem for as long as I've been looking at this, and that has been exacerbated by what I showed before is the consolidation of single specialty medical groups. So, for example, in Seattle, where I'm from, there is basically one group of orthopedic surgeons. They don't take Medicaid anymore, and I don't think they're taking any charity patients anymore, which means that access for those groups in Seattle is almost zero. Greater competition for clinical staff, especially given the greater diversity in our communities, competition for staff who are culturally and linguistically competent is very intense. And of course, throughout this the APHA meeting, there's been lots of sessions about need for greater accountability, a focus on disparities and quality, and all that puts greater pressure on providers of all types. So how have safety net providers responded to these pressures? We categorize the responses that we observed in two categories, defensive and offensive, somewhat arbitrarily. So one thing that particularly hospitals have done in some places, including Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, UCI in Orange County, they basically said for non-emergency patients, we're no longer going to take anybody. We're only going to take people who are within our neighboring zip codes, or in the case of Harborview, in the county that we sit in. They haven't shut off the emergency department, but if it's non-emergency, we're no longer taking people outside, sort of to fight off the wallet biopsy kind of problem. Developing referral arrangements. Now, part of this is actually positive. What we've seen is, in many cases, safety net hospitals trying to figure out how to get their emergency rooms to operate more efficiently and to develop really strong referral arrangements, particularly with community health centers, so that people are getting more appropriate care. So that can be a very positive thing. And then enforcing financial policies, sliding fee scales and the like. Offensive actions. Marketing to insured patients. This has been true for not only traditional safety net hospitals, but also community health centers have been going after insured patients, including Medicare, leveraging competitive advantages. One good example of that, and it's not listed here, but in Indianapolis, one of the largest independent community health center systems negotiated a takeover of the OB residency program at one of the hospitals, and when we were there last, was negotiating to also take over the pediatric residency program, which could improve continuity of care for the families involved. Upgrading facilities, as I mentioned before, expanding into new services, changing the safety net image. This is a very subtle thing in talking to traditional safety net hospitals, not everywhere, but basically some expression of the desire not to be seen as just the safety net hospital, but more as a pillar of the medical care system, which many of these safety net hospitals had that reputation in the past. Community health center responses, in particular, I'll highlight here. Just to say, I've been a long time admirer of community health centers as a community health planner, as a policy advocate. Here in my role as a researcher in this project, I've been very impressed with the continual entrepreneurialism in the community health center system. We see lots of innovation in the medical care system. I would say most of that innovation is at best useless. But in among community health centers in particular, it's amazing what they've been able to do over the last 10 years to survive and to be able to continue to serve their patients. So what you see is the development of new health centers and additional sites of existing health centers, a broadening of services. Community health centers have a reputation for providing a wide range of services, and they've continued to do that. Collaborations have been very important, and as I said, attracting privately insured and Medicare patients. So what are the challenges and opportunities? Now, I uploaded this to the APHA site before the debacle on Wall Street, so you know, malaise might be too soft a term. That's sort of a Carter-esque a term. But nonetheless, we know that public subsidies are critical for the survival of the safety net. And those subsidies, barring some progressive action on the part of Congress in particular, are at risk. And that's going to be a big challenge. Universal coverage initiatives, again, you know, if we see an Obama administration try to make a move on universal coverage, it is a bit of a dilemma for safety net providers. We can see this in Massachusetts in particular. When money is moved from supporting charity care to subsidizing insurance, safety net providers often hit a double-edged problem. One is they lose the patients that they were formerly seeing because they're now insured and they can go other places, and they lose the subsidies for remaining uninsured people. So that's a bit of a concern. But there are opportunities. Clearly, the whole brouhaha about medical homes, the latest, greatest idea, well, community health centers in particular are have been honing that model for decades and I think are well-placed to win at that game. And then, of course, their expertise in caring for complex patients, both complex acute patients as well as chronic care. So, you know, I continue to be optimistic about the safety net because of their ability to innovate and keep their head above water. But I think this is an area that none of us can be complacent about because this is a key part of the system of access for low-income folks. Thanks.
We don't have time this moment for questions, but there should be some time at the end. The next talk, this is Health Economics and Access. And the next talk is by Carol Simon, I believe. And her talk is, look up what it is here, A Comparison of Determinants of Primary Care Physician Participation in Medicare and Medicaid in 5 States.
Very good.